Welcome back to another edition of Irish Illustrated Insider. I'm Tim O'Malley, joined today by Tim Priester and Andrew Mentock of Irish Illustrated. We are a weekend removed from our last media access period, one that included two handfuls of wide receivers and the three running backs currently tasked with replacing Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price, and their position coaches, Mike Brown and Jawan Sider. So guys, before we get into newer news, I wanted to kind of review Friday. Interviews with Mike Brown, a heck of a lot of wide receivers that came out together, and then Jawan Sider. Tim, we'll throw it to you first. I know we're all kind of riding on the wide receivers, and we had the whole double handful come out at the same time, so we were scrambling a little bit. But there's a lot of wide receivers to talk to, because finally, they have a big wide receiver.
Yeah, we were bombarded by wide receivers the other day. There was no way for the media corps upstairs to keep up with it. But
it was like a 2004 Notre Dame secondary. We were being bombarded by wide receivers.
No, it was great. It was a great opportunity to get to know some of those guys. I talked to Micah Gilbert. I'd never really talked to Micah Gilbert with anything that was in depth. But I keep coming away from these interviews and saying we still haven't seen anything yet, but all we hear is great things. This is Nolan James Jr., the running back. I mean, Jawan Sider said he's the most mature kid I've ever been around. He talked about he mentioned man crush just because he's so prepared. He's so prepared for everything. And we haven't seen him, like you guys haven't seen a single play on the practice field where it's like,
Blue Gold, I mean, maybe you have. Maybe you have. Blue Gold game last year. He looked really good.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But it was against the threes and putting your pen down time of the day. Yeah, it was.
Nolan James Jr. is as committed to the cause as CJ Carr, and that's saying a lot. Their lives revolve around being student athletes, their lives revolve around being prepared for football every day, eating right, going to bed early, all that kind of stuff. And I'm fascinated to see what Nolan James Jr. can do when we've got the Jersey scrimmage coming up in the Blue Gold game. So we're going to get a really good look at him then.
Yeah, I agree. The Jersey scrimmage, I think, will tell a lot because we're just hearing these positive things. I mean, we've seen some stuff from Aeneas Williams and it's good to see that he can do some stuff right now. Once they go full contact, that will probably change, but he's pretty involved in practice up to this point. So even though he's got this big, bulky elbow brace on, the most experienced running back in the room is still able to do a lot of stuff. He's taking a big leadership role. I agree with James. I think the other thing Sider made a big point of emphasis is that we perceive him as small, but he is listed at 212 pounds, which is the same as Jeremiah Love was listed at last year. So for a young guy who doesn't come across as big, he does have a decent amount of size. So I'm pretty curious how he kind of carries that. And I agree with the wide receiver room. I mean, transcribing was difficult because they had them so close together that you were hearing other conversations.
They used to do that all the time, by the way, Drew. It was awful. Like they would just sit. Remember, Tim, they'd in the Isbin Auditorium, they just sit next to each other. You're like, this is not going to work, guys. This is
yeah.
Not.
And if it's Mike Denbrock's day, he speaks very loud, and so right. he wasn't with that group. But yeah, Nolan James said he's 216 now. He said he fluctuated. When he was at 208, 212, he'd wake up, he'd be 208, he'd wake up, he'd be 211. He said, I'm a consistent 216 now. And again, not seeing enough live action, but he really seems to carry that weight well. And that's why when you guys first saw James last year, like the first impression was, man, he's small. I remember the press corps saying that, and I thought, I don't really think so. So he's kind of grown into his body, and I'm just really intrigued by him. I'm intrigued by Micah Gilbert too, because everybody in the organization believes this is year three. It's time for Micah Gilbert. He's had a couple of injuries. Mike Brown called them freak. Mike Denbrock knocked on wood 10 times about Gilbert staying healthy. They think he's a playmaker. Denbrock said, he's faster than you think he is. He's a clear boundary. By the way, I think we have a boundary depth chart, even though Mike Brown said, can you help me with the depth chart? Because I have it figured out. But, obviously Quincy Porter will be there when he's healthy. Gilbert, Cam Williams has worked there. Jerome Bettis has worked there. And Devin Fitzgerald has worked there. I think Caden Finley has mainly worked inside. So we got
to
peck.
Go back to Drew, though, on the Nolan James thing. He was going through Nolan James, our running back situation, and how he's what you said, Tim, is just like it is. He is as dedicated as CJ Carr to his craft. It's amazing.
Yeah, and then, I mean, Sider was just glowing about it. I mean, he was almost maybe a little over the top. Like sometimes you're wondering, who else is he speaking to with these comments, praising a freshman like that? But yeah, I mean, just couldn't stop talking. He's like the guy, type of guy you have to almost tell to go home, which I think is an encouraging sign for a guy that you might count on a lot from this year.
Pretty sure you mentioned all the W's. Did you talk to Mike Brown at all about any of the other positions? I
I
couldn't ask.
really, no, I just dropped in on him because
There's
I
so
mean,
many.
yeah, I mean, it's just like we're all going through our head like, okay, I've got to get to him, and him. And so I mainly wanted to comment on him from Gilbert because I knew I wanted to get a feature on him. Drew, I hope I didn't step on your toes with the Gilbert feature,
No,
but
no.
no, I did. No, I did not get a chance to do that, Tim.
The only thing I was trying to figure out, of course, you got the W's down so we can kind of figure it out there from the X's and the slots. It was funny. I asked Burris about learning two positions, and Gilbert said, I know all the positions. I can play anything. Now he has an extra year in the program too. And Burris kind of mentioned, I work at the field side. I work at X, and that's so I asked Mike Brown about it. Like, do they the spring is usually, Tim, about cross training, right? Like, you hear about all the cross training positions, and Mike Brown says to me, he goes, Bubba Frazier's been here a couple months. How many positions do you want to play? I was like, that's true, I suppose. So maybe cross training is for the
Well,
Gilbert and older group.
yeah, and I don't think you, because you have the bodies, you don't have to cross train as much. And I
Right,
asked
that's true.
him which guys are moving, we always kind of pigeonhole them. Oh, he's a X or he's a Z, but they do move around. They don't always align like that. But I asked him which of the guys are moving, and the three that he mentioned to me were Faison, which Faison looks, does not, does he not look bigger and stronger? My goodness. I like, just like head and neck, he's a bigger dude now, and I think he's going to have a sensational season. So anyway, the guys that moved were Saldate also, which we knew, Faison and Mylon Graham. I don't think he mentioned any beyond those three, and they would be moving between, well, I think just Graham. I mean, you just want Graham on the field, you line them up. If that's in the slot, it's in the slot, right? I mean,
Yeah, I think it's easy to see like Faison and Graham being kind of interchangeable in what they can do. And I agree with Faison. I mean, I've been pretty high on what he could do since he gave up lacrosse. And you talk about he's like, my body just feels different. Like I've noticed a difference from day one. Like I was trying to do two sports. He can probably change his body a little differently compared to what it would have been for lacrosse, which is like very physical, but in a different way. Like think about the beat. Like I know we see other football players play baseball, but think about the beating you play and take in the cross too, and just having to deal with that year round. And now he actually can kind of get a little bit of a break and focus on one sport. So I'm really curious what that can do. And I mean, his biggest issue in the past, especially sophomore year, was staying on the field. So he should be able to potentially do that better with the recuperation and just being able to take care of his body better in general too.
Also getting a break a little bit too long has been Jaden Greathouse. I talked to Greathouse for a while and I asked him, at what point did you shut it down for the playoff run, obviously, because he had played a couple games, and once you want to lose that redshirt year, and he said it was until a couple weeks after USC. So if you figure that's about the 17th of October, hit November, that's when you want to shut it down. And then of course he's like, but there was no playoff run. So he has just mentioned how much he wants to play football again. I mean, how frustrating it was. Tim, he has to have frustrations when he says, I brought him back to his freshman year hamstring. He's like, I don't even remember which hamstring that was. That's a rough, and he said that was nothing compared to this one. Like
Right.
this was way worse. But
This
he's like,
was way
I
more
don't. It
severe.
kept him out of a game or two, though. That's tough.
He might be a guy that moves a little bit between, X. I probably have boundary X and Z, but yeah, and we have a question. We got a question from friend of ours, David, later on about, the wideouts truly leading in the pass catching, and I think it's a good point because. I mean, I don't know which tight end would, if Eli Raridan was still on the roster, that would be in doubt, but I'm not sure which tight end emerges. This is going to be a wide receiver driven passing game.
Maybe the tight end's not here yet.
Maybe not.
Your guy. Although that is tough as a freshman. I mean, there's been one really that's ever done that as a freshman.
And he, if anybody else can, I would put money on Ian Premer.
You would put it on it, yeah.
Yeah.
I will say, it wasn't Brown, so it had to be Gaduli. I asked a question about Carr getting used to the receivers. because so many new guys to get used to. And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, he has a rapport with some guys already. So that's what spring is for. And then the summer months is on them. And he's like, everybody's, you know, a lot of people are here. And he goes, except, and he literally mentioned the guy coming in by name. And that
really
does not happen a lot when you are a position coach. It's like, I was like, oh, I didn't even offer that name. So that might
be when 27 of the 30 freshmen are here, you don't expect it. Hey, if I could, and I apologize if I'm dominating this, but I thought Guduli said some really interesting things about expectations on Carr. And he's like, he did great. You know, he did a great job last year. All he's got to do is what he did last year. Now, none of us fully believe that. He needs to evolve in areas of his game. CJ Carr doesn't believe that, that's for sure, because he's so meticulous about his game. But I think the point was the last thing that CJ Carr needs is greater expectations. They're going to be placed on him. He knows he needs to be better in the pocket. You know, I've been harping on him getting stronger. But I thought it was interesting that Guduli would, you know, just kind of pull back a little bit. He doesn't have to be Superman. He just needs to follow through with the normal progression of his abilities, which are immense. So, and then I asked Carr about that too, and he's just like, I just got to be a better leader and just keep getting better every day. And so I really, that whole notion, I thought it was interesting and I really took to it because it's just like, there's going to be a ton of pressure from the outside placed on CJ Carr. He doesn't need that. He just needs to be CJ Carr.
Yeah. And I think he's a guy who places an enormous amount of pressure on himself. I mean, I think we saw how that impacted him last fall. So why do much of that? I think that's probably a sign of a good coach. Like, you know, who to pull back on and who probably needs a little extra push. I don't think CJ Carr needs any extra pushing to progress this offseason.
No, he seems natural for that. Yeah, it was a good point, Tim. I kind of asked him, like, so is leadership the main growth spot? He's like, yeah, but he's always been a leader too. He just has to know we got a Don Shuler coming back as a captain. When you have a couple returning captains, and then there's a natural leader in Anthony Knapp going into his third year, I think, here. I know he's a junior on the line, but Ashton Craig with the injuries, I would actually be surprised if Anthony Knapp is not one of the captains this year. I just feel that he is
that's a good call
type of guy. Yeah. And it could easily be Ashton Craig. It's just he's got other things.
I asked Carr about, you know, pocket presence and moving around. And, you know, because he would get flushed. When he got flushed, the play was over a lot of times. And, you know, he needs to be able to get back upfield, square shoulders, and look downfield. He made the point that, you know, he was splitting one rep, so he didn't get all of those pressure reps that he would have, that he will now, you know, as the number one guy. So, you know, he's confident that he'll get things straightened out, and anybody that's around CJ Carr is pretty confident that he'll accomplish pretty much whatever he puts his mind to.
Before we get to an incoming running back and a possible other incoming running back, we did speak with Kedron Young. I know people would like to hear a little bit from Young. He said he started running either the day we were talking to him or that week. So running, not jogging, which I think is a pretty big deal for him going to the spring. And he's the same as Jaden Greathouse. He's like, I need to play football. I haven't played football in so long. So my question is, how do you approach camp when you're actually able to play football, but you like the rushing back into it feeling for Kedron Young? He knows he has to be cautious. Jaden Greathouse knows he has to be cautious with the hamstring injury that keeps happening. But like these two guys just need to play football. And guys, I think it's more important for Young because he has not played meaningful football at Notre Dame. It's shocking, really, that he's been on our mind for so long. And Aeneas Williams is going to his junior year. So is Kedron Young.
Yeah, and it's probably good that he doesn't have expectations of doing anything this spring. So then he can kind of, he's running now. He can have the summer. So conceivably, once he does get out on the field, and I mean, in the fall, it's not like they can put on full pads right away either. So he'll have some time to progress into it. But I agree, he won't have the luxury of being able to hold back. There's not really much to go off of, like there even is with Greathouse, where at least you've seen what he can do at a high level with Young. I mean, he's pretty much been out and stuff the whole time.
Tim, we speculate about his weight and what it means a lot because he's fluctuated 20 pounds a couple times. He said he wants to play 235. So now everybody listening, when you look at the August training camp report, if he's in that range, that's where Kedron Young feels best.
Well, we had noted coming out of the winter that he was down. I don't remember what the number was, but now he's back up when they weighed him right before the start of spring, I assume.
he said he didn't want to lose all that weight. It was at this time, because remember, after his freshman year, he had the hamstring problem. He lost weight on purpose, looked great. He said this was more a function of the injury and just
not the same. Well, look, they need, I mean, you always have to be prepared with a third back. He would be the guy to do it. I know he said in the past, you know, short yardage. What, dude, if you're 235, you got to be a short yardage back. Like, I mean, that's got to be something on your resume. That's got to be part of your role.
Part of it, yeah.
And you know, so in that sense, they need it. Osborne's hurt. Yeah. Speaking of, I mean, Sider was talking about how, were either of you guys there when he talked about how the intelligence of Jonas Walton?
No, but you mentioned it to me. Yeah, go ahead. That's great.
Well, I mean, I think he referenced him like a scientist.
Yes.
Being that smart, I guess I was around Walton a little bit for a minute, again, bouncing around. But, you know, so with Osborne hurt, I don't know how good the scientist is actually at playing college football yet, but it's always a promising thing when you know a guy understands the game at a different level than most.
Yeah, and Sider, a former quarterback, likes to explain the game further than you might think a running back needs to know, so I think that helps him. And he also clarified that Walton, he said sometimes that like book smart, that scientist smart, doesn't translate to the football field, and he says it does with Walton too. So that must be an encouraging sign that he's throwing a lot at him, and Walton seems to be picking it up early on.
Tim, last weekend's podcast, or last Thursday, we did talk about Lathan Wizenton. I know you wanted to offer a little bit of a film review there, and also Springfield, Mass's Isaiah Rogers is expected to choose Notre Dame today. I think this announcement's around 2:00. Let's go back to Wizenton first, because I know I read your film review in waiting. So
I really like him. I think it listed number 299. I think that's way underrated. And actually, Isaiah Rogers is rated ahead of him, and I would place Wizenton ahead of Rogers. Now Rogers is really fast. He's an outside guy. You know, most of what they do at his high school is designed to run wide, but he's not averse to running between the tackles. But I really like Wizenton. He is a well-rounded football player. I think his greatest asset, it's difficult for me to say, he has tremendous vision. You will see him zigzag in and out through the line of scrimmage, and it's just really impressive. But he's also been timed at 10.54 in the 100 meters. He can be physical. He's got a strong lower body. I really think that at 299, he's a very underrated football player. He doesn't catch the football, so that's one thing that's lacking. Isaiah Rogers does have a background in catching the football. The one thing that Wizenton's going to have to learn when he gets to the college level is how to celebrate with his teammates after a touchdown. He is a no-celebrating dude. He scores. He puts the football down and he goes back to his team on the sideline. I don't think I ever saw him get really excited about a play. He ran for 1,500 yards and 9 yards a carry last year. I think he's a really, really good football player. I think he's underrated at 299. And Rogers, he's listed 205. I think he'll be 205 someday, but I don't think he's quite there yet. But he's more of an outside runner. He can run between the tackles. And I know, you know, Notre Dame fans, they wanted Keeman Spell and David Cigar is a guy that, you know, they like. Cigar's not as sudden as Isaiah Rogers. He doesn't have that quick twitch that Isaiah Rogers has. I know that Cigar is rated higher and a lot of people like him better. I like Rogers. I think Rogers has a greater upside than he does.
Yeah, but I think the 10.54 too, I think he ran that on February 21st of this year, which, based on the little bit I know about high school track, is you get faster as the season goes along too. So, and that's just like a just really impressive time. I tried to look. I think it's faster than Jeremiah Love ever ran in high school track. Obviously not comparing him to Jeremiah Love, but I think this is a different level.
Oh, you just
of speed.
Did. Just did. Yeah. Jeremiah Talk compared to Jeremiah Love. Okay. Everybody get that on. Tweeted that out real fast.
Yeah. So he already runs a 4.36 just like Jeremiah. No. But yeah, he has a lot. I just think that speed is rare, and I think that's something that may be missing from this current group of running backs. I don't know if there is that truly elite speed that we've kind of gotten used to or spoiled with the last few years with Notre Dame running backs. So he is the type of guy that I think maybe brings in something they might not currently have, which is that like elite level breakaway speed in the backfield.
Glad you brought that up, because James and Aeneas Williams walked in together, and you want to talk about exact carbon copy of each other walking into a room. I mean, they're just short, stocky, strong dudes. It just looks like that would not be fun to tackle. Sometimes people think bigger guys are hard to tackle. You look at this, where are you going to grab? Like, where are you going to hit? It's just a ball of power with both of those guys.
That's the, you know, Den Brock said that James hovers over the ground, which I don't think I've ever heard that reference to a running back. And it's about low center of gravity. That's what James said. And just being able to, knowing at what level that you have to play at as you're about to make contact with a defender.
Shifting gears to basketball, I want to, W. Jason P., a longtime subscriber, gave us a great question. Summarize this Notre Dame women's season in one word.
Go ahead, Drew.
I think I went with vindicating just because I think Ivy took a lot of flack, a lot of justifiably so throughout the last few seasons. And I do think to a degree, I mean, this team was definitely less talented than last year's team by a long shot. But I think she probably did a lot of her best coaching. I think she probably has a better idea of what she wants out of a player in terms of like personality and building a culture and some of those other things that she needs to show she can do. I'd still like to see her have probably a deeper rotation. And I think those type of things would serve her well. But I think if you go back to January when they lost to UConn by 40, the sky was falling with this program. You couldn't believe the team that arguably has the best player in the country looks like they did at that time. And she really turned things around. And I think UConn did a really good job handling Hidalgo yesterday. And that, I mean, that might be one of Geno's best teams. And they fought pretty hard and kept it as competitive as you want. I think the spread was 29.5 going into that game. So I know they lost by a lot, but they still covered by double digits. So, yeah, I think they really proved a lot.
Notre Dame was like one of a handful of opponents that lost by less than 20 to Connecticut this year. So 29.5. Vindicating is a great word, Drew. I wrote progressing, but that doesn't nearly encapsulate what they did. I you know, all the respect in the world for what Nia Ivey did with the team in the postseason. I thought they would lose to Ohio State. I said that on a podcast. They didn't. I thought they would lose to Vanderbilt. They did not, and they hung tough with UConn. You know, I think it's a real testament to, and I've been very critical of her coaching at times, but you don't get better like that at the most crucial time of the season unless you're doing some pretty damn good coaching, and it helps to have Hannah Hidalgo, but the surrounding cast isn't very impressive right now. To your point, Drew, they need more talent. I don't know how much you can tap into the rotation until you get more healthy talent, and health has been an issue with them. But all the credit in the world to what they did in the postseason, the NCAA tournament, because that was a heck of a run, and they played as well as you could expect against Connecticut yesterday.
Yeah, mine is promising. Right along the, when's the last time that season ended and you thought, well, that's a promising sign going into next year, as opposed to, oh God, not in the Elite Eight again? Like that's how you felt the last 3 years. They fell short. This team maxed out considering what they,
no doubt.
Yeah. You went two upset wins in the NCAA tournament and then play Connecticut as hard as you possibly. I mean, Connecticut's a wagon juggernaut right now, just pounding people. So can't score 91 when I need them to, but they are a very powerful team. I don't know if you guys caught any men's college basketball or yesterday. There was a pretty big shot that went in. Second, top three most thrilling finishes you could watch as a college basketball fan. I mean, Leitner's shot's hard to beat because of the improbability of making the catch and doing all those things. This is right there, Tim Priester, and it was Greenfield Central Zone, Braylon Mullins, and I thought Danny Hurley, who is honestly Danny Hurley.
he's a caricature. He's a caricature of himself or something.
He's also a 17-1 caricature.
Unbelievable.
Covering and winning in the last 4 years.
Three Final Fours in 4 years. Braylon Mullins, incredible. I mean, who is sitting in front of their TV watching and silently observed what happened there? I mean, everybody, you have to yell out for something like that.
That was me, my wife, and Charlie. We never just exploded.
bad mistake by Cam Boozer's brother. A ball fake and a pivot probably gets you out of that, and the ball gets ahead. And right? I mean, we've all played a ball fake and a wraparound. Once you get them up in the air, it ends the game.
Or just hold on to the ball.
Like, or that.
Or that. To not turn the ball over with the time left in the game. Like, if even if you got a 10-second violation, well, there have been almost no time left for them.
It was
to
10.0 like when they
got it, actually. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, it would have been game. You just needed to cower and hide the ball. But
people are piling on Boozer and obviously, you know, Shire. I'm sure Shire said there's 10 seconds left. But you probably didn't say we don't have to get it across half court. But you should say, and I could second guess this because this is an easy thing to do. You could first guess this. If you're a basketball point guard and a coach, there's 10 seconds left. You got to bring the ball up the court. You also know when there's 3 seconds left, you can roll the ball down to the other end, and they're going to be inbounding it from 94 feet away. I mean, I hate to use Magic Johnson as my example because he's the smartest player in the history of the world, but Magic Johnson did it. No, you do know. You have to know the time situation. I feel bad for Boozer. Seth Greenberg, former Virginia Tech coach, longtime analyst now, made a tremendous point kind of near yours, Tim. He goes, the biggest problem was he caught the ball and did something you're not supposed to do. He dribbled. You're supposed to catch the ball and figure something out, and then you have your dribble. In other words, if he caught the ball and looked, you can still do two dribbles.
Yeah, and keeping it in the backcourt, that's an unusual coaching situation, but you better alert your team to what you possible. Can do. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's that a shot for the ages, obviously, everybody had. To react, that's a great point. For
unbelievable
situation.
I stood up for sure, and I do remember he camped at Notre Dame 2 summers ago with his high school. He was playing point guard. He was out of position, so he didn't look the best. But I mean, I remember talking to him after, and he definitely seemed like the type of guy who would definitely fit at Notre Dame. And I think his ranking blew up after that. But he was an Indiana guy who was definitely recruited by this coaching staff and on campus.
Well, I tell you what, when Danny Hurley, the national champion, 2-time national champion, comes up to you and says, we're going to bring you back to Indianapolis for the Final Four, you do listen to that recruiting pitch because that's what is exactly happening. And he shot them back there. Priester, really quickly, JJ Elwine, longtime contributor, said, is Boozer's turn? He actually said, called him Boozer the Lesser. Is Boozer's turnover akin to any Notre Dame faux pas?
You included that, so what's yours?
The worst ones I could think, because he actually included football ones you can think of as well. The worst one I can think of are physical ones, that when you lose a game on a situation like that. The coaching one we always talk about is Brian Kelly.
Northwestern,
because you can second guess anything a coach has ever done, be right or wrong, and you're not in that position. That is just math. That was the same
situation. That was math.
But that's still hard for Boozer because he was put in a pressure situation as that was going on. It's really the worst. I want to come to Boozer's defense. By the way, he spoke. Think of all the people we have seen for Notre Dame and somewhere else that are the clear goat of the moment. Not goat. Goat the other way. The old school goat of the moment. He spoke post-game as a freshman. Came right out and talked in the locker room. That does not happen in a lot of
locker rooms. That's amazing. I just don't think my instinct in that situation would have been to try to throw over the top of it.
Right.
I would hope not.
He made a mistake. But it was bad luck how it got tipped, too. Like, it could have been tipped out of bounds. It could have been tipped back to him. Like, there's so many. Could have just tipped and trickled down the court to one of his teammates. It was really unfortunate. I always think of the first thing I thought of when I saw the question was David Rivers bouncing it off his foot to lose the game. But that was to Kenny Smith. I don't know if people know this, but Notre Dame hosted NCAA tournament games, and they had North Carolina here in the second round, and David Rivers, the best ball handler in Notre Dame history, dribbled off his foot. Kenny Smith went and dunked it for the winning basket to end the NCAA tournament game here. That's the one that I think of right away, Tim. This was more mental. That was more a physical accident that you never expect someone to make.
Yeah.
I thought of football, and I mean, closest like recent thing I could think of is Riley Leonard's interception against Northern Illinois. That wasn't like at the very end of the game, but they were up by one still. They had the ball at the 52nd and one, and he chucks it downfield into double coverage and underthrows it, and that's like what changed the game. So not quite the same, but it was a mental error that was just like, that doesn't make sense.
I'm sure our listeners
also former Duke guy. Sorry.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
That part didn't hurt at all watching that
game. And a former basketball player himself.
Yeah.
I'm sure our readers and subscribers will come up with some Notre Dame faux pas through the years.
Yeah, I'm sure they still hurt. That's why you're a fan of these such things. But honestly, Tim, probably you're hitting second or third most famous shot in Elite Eight history, in NCAA tournament history. Christian Leitner might have had the top two. And now they can at least stick somebody in between Leitner for all the people that don't like Duke.
Flipping the script with Duke and Connecticut many years later.
We'll be back with segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Welcome back to segment two, Burning Up the Boards. Our first question from Irish 1981. Not a great year for Notre Dame football in 1981, Tim, unless he's a basketball fan. In Notre Dame's two losses, they averaged 114 rushing yards per game and had a stuff rate near 20%. Any idea how Mike Denbrock can fix this? Is it through scheme change, play design, or whatever?
I we've said a couple times, I think Cooper Flanagan will help tremendously in that area. You know who else would help tremendously? A fully strong, conditioned Charles Jagusa, which, you know, you can't replace the time missed in the weight room. And so whether he'll be ready or not, you know, we're not going to get the best version of Charles Jagusa if he plays in 2026. I know, slow developing plays. I think maybe that's the hint here with this question with Denbrock's calls. I think a stronger CJ Carr under center that could plow forward on fourth and one would be a huge benefit. But this offensive line has to come together. I'm going to answer offensive line on another question here. I think it comes down to that gelling. Maybe moving Knapp inside will be beneficial. That's what I would say.
Yeah, I think the Miami game is the worst of the two. I mean, they definitely moved the ball well against A&M, even if they weren't rushing it. But I mean, you have two first rounders on the defensive end for Miami, but they still, I mean, both tackles were cramping. They weren't really handling the atmosphere well. And I think the line just really suffered. So while I think maybe Denbrock could have done some different things, I think the players weren't really up to the challenge, and he did his best just to get the ball outside sometimes and like quick screens to wide receivers and stuff to try and move the ball. And obviously then there was an interception by one of those defensive ends that kind of ruined that too.
I go more on the opponent for these first two games too. Miami's top three rush defense in the country last year, and they were ahead of Notre Dame's offensive line to start that game. They were more developed product.
Yes.
And Texas A&M is only like top 30 rush defense, but they're the number one third down defense in the country. And that's where
Notre Dame. A&M wasn't necessarily, well, defensively, they weren't playing their best football early on. Yeah, I was going to point out, I mean, who ran successfully against Miami last year? I'm sure there were a couple of teams, but overall, you don't do it. So solving those problems are difficult for Notre Dame and everybody else. But Notre Dame has the offensive line talent if they can gel, and then Flanagan helps. Maybe Knapp inside helps.
I think the running back style helps.
That's a good point. Lower target, lower center of gravity. I think that's a good point. I think, I think the Notre Dame offensive staff is expecting Aeneas Williams and Nolan James Jr. to break tackles with some regularity.
Yeah, I think they'll break just as many. They just won't do what Jeremiah Locke did after the break of the tackle. That's how I look at it. I think they'll be tremendous in short space.
I think that's a good point. I think Love got better at it as the year went on, but I think early in the year he was trying to turn in some of those like plays where he was getting hit in the backfield. He was still trying to turn them into 40-yard gains rather than be like, I need 2 yards, like let me make sure I get this first. And I don't think either of the other two will try and do that at all or anywhere near to the same degree.
And remember, not at this point, after game 3 or 4, we were saying they have to scrap the Wildcat in the backfield. That was part of it. So schematically, the Wildcat was not working for Notre Dame in the short yardage situation. It's hard to run Wildcat against those attacking defensive lines of Miami and Texas A&M too.
I don't really know how good of a blocker Washington is at tight end, but I'm very confident that both Flanagan's, I'm not very confident, the Notre Dame coaching staff is confident, therefore I am, that those two guys are going to be really, really good blockers. Those, the two Flanagan's on the field together, healthy, a year stronger in both, you know, Achilles healed and all that. I think that's going to be a pretty powerful duo at tight end.
I thought Washington got better blocking as the season progressed. And I know that's, you know, faint praise because he was poor at it when the season started, but he also had the thumb. He did have a thumb injury. Right. Remember, he barely played.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah. I do think he got better. And I don't think he'd have been welcomed back with open arms if they don't think he got better at it. But I agree with you. The firm of Flanagan and Flanagan should do a very good job in that regard. Next question from Packy P. After reading Pete Sampson's article and listening to the podcast about CJ Carr and first team reps, I can't help but think the Indy coaching staff overthought the QB competition last year. and it most likely cost us an undefeated season and playoff run. Do you think they should have been more decisive in the spring, knowing CJ didn't do anything not to warrant being handed the keys, especially the given you have behind him in Love and Price?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that's easy to say in hindsight, but you still had a guy who was hurt most of his freshman fall, didn't do a ton there. Like, you can't just give him the keys over a guy who, you know, and Minshew was also like highly rated, and Angeli had, when he had gotten the field, had always done things well, to just give him the keys and be like, well, you had a good spring. I don't know. That doesn't make it. They still ran off one of those quarterbacks too. They let him leave and narrowed the competition before the fall. So it's also, I think, rare for, he just handled that competition poorly in August. Usually if a guy does that, you don't think, well, once he's through this competition, he'll be better. Like, that is kind of a weird mentality, just because of so much pressure he put on himself. And then once we got rid of that, he was better. So I think if you had a time machine, I guess you could do that. But I think for the culture of your team, you have to go through that competition, and you can't just give the youngest quarterback on your team, who's been, again, hurt a lot of the time he was actually on the field as a freshman, the keys without making him earn it.
I think it's a very fair question in retrospect, and I understand the question completely. Drew, I completely agree with you. It's so weird that CJ Carr, I mean, you can say he didn't do anything during preseason to lose the job or not win the job, but he kind of did. He succumbed to the pressure within the team, which is crazy. Like, once he was named the starting quarterback, it was like, okay, everything's in order now. Here I go. How he, that's just really
surprising.
It's just kind of inexplicable. It's something that you don't expect. And so, but I do think it was a fair question. I think Kenny Minchie held his own, but I think, and maybe this is unfair and Marcus Freeman could refute it, but I think Marcus Freeman knew all along he was going to pick Carr, because there were metrics that we were kind of made privy to that. I mean, Carr could push the ball down the field with accuracy and Minchie couldn't. And clearly they wanted to be able to open up the offense a little bit and have that deep threat. How often does a CJ Carr come along that gives you that kind of, you know, deep ball accuracy? So I think Freeman knew all along he would win it, but you preach, you know, busting your ass and putting yourself in a position to be a starter or a contributor. Well, you got to leave the door open for competition. I wouldn't go so far as to say that it likely cost Notre Dame an undefeated season. I mean, the defense had a lot to do with the problem, certainly in game two. But I think it's a fair question, and I will always think that Freeman knew ultimately that he was going to pick Carr, but Minshew made it interesting, and Carr did some quirky things that you wouldn't expect from a great competitor like he is.
Things we know are that Minshew made what we thought was a pretend three-quarterback spring competition, a real three-quarterback spring competition that surprised them. We also know there was a split on the staff with Minshew, Angeli, and Carr exiting the spring. One of them left. Then Minshew played well in August camp. I mean, you're just literally not practicing what you preach if this doesn't continue. They fully expected CJ Carr to win the job faster than he did. And it came down to the last time they could make a decision. You had to go into 2 weeks of preparation. Tim Priester, your word is right. It's inexplicable that it happened the way how well CJ Carr played after that competition was that close. I know for a fact there's an offensive coordinator, a quarterback's coach, and a head coach that thought three different things in the spring about three different people. That's not like, oh, this is over.
Yeah.
You had to go into it for a week at least. And then all of a sudden it's a problem for the first 10 days that it's close. That's hard to just say, okay, it's Carr, even though he's the better player. But if you have a competition and it looks like a good competition, it's tough to just name
that. Well, and Marcus Freeman's the king of, look, this is open competition. I'm going to give everybody an opportunity to win the job. That's different as a head coach. That's really difficult to do because you have notions about what a player is going to be. And then you look on the field and the competition is more even than you think it should be. That's difficult to do. It's one of the more difficult aspects of coaching, especially in a game with as many moving parts as football has.
Yeah, and you don't want to take that away from the other players where they're watching that too, and they're thinking, well, you told me if I compete and do well, I have a chance at this job. And if they don't see it at the most important, most microscopic position on the team, they're, that kind of goes away for everyone else a little bit too.
Go ahead, Drew.
Our next question is from WakeemUp408. Notre Dame hasn't had a season with three wide receivers finishing as its top three in receiving yards since 2018. If you absolutely had to bet a life-changing amount of money, would you bet yes or no for 2026?
Go ahead, Tim.
Faison, Graham, Greathouse. I mean, there's your top three if they're healthy, right?
You got to guarantee me the third guy's healthy.
Yeah.
Hamstrings recur. Reoccur.
Yeah, they do.
I would not bet a life-changing amount of money because I think Aeneas Williams could sneak in there.
Yeah,
actually, I would bet. Okay, I get the field. I take the field over number three.
I would too. Yeah, no, I would too. Just because we don't know, you know, Premier may have that kind of ability. I don't think.
You know what Aeneas can catch. He's
yeah. Well, but it sure looks that way.
I think Aeneas would be my biggest, I guess, concern on betting yes on that. I think. Yeah, there's not a tight end. Primer, also, when he was on campus, I think he was in a boot 2 weeks ago, and I just talked to Eric. I think he's missed the rest of his basketball season because of a foot injury. So I don't know how long that will linger, but he's not, for as talented as he is, he's not here yet, and he's also dealing with some sort of injury that would give me pause to think it will be a tight end that would do it.
Here's one other thing about the difference. With the, so 2018 is when it happened, Boykin, Claypool, and Fink, obviously. The running back on that team was Dexter Williams, who played nine games and was notorious for not being able to catch. Aeneas Williams plays 13 games on that team. He might have snuck in there. Now, I think those three guys still would have done it because they played so many. They were the three guys. You can't even name the fourth guy at that point. On the, I mean, that was like Komet was young. That's just a, those guys were clearly the guys. But he's pretty well known. I mean, DeShone Kizer made fun of Dexter Williams on social media when he caught a touchdown pass, saying, "I can't believe he caught it," or something like that. Yeah. So, you know, he's,
you know, and then, I mean, if not Greathouse Gilbert, if not Gilbert Porter,
it's a great question. I'll go field. I really like Aeneas Williams catching the ball. Like,
yeah, no, it's great. That's our friend David submitting the question. Yeah. That'll be something. I know he'll keep an eye on it for us and monitor how we're coming along there. We have a question from Kevin O'Neill, and it is, as a perpetually paranoid fan, I can't shake the feeling that the way pundits and analysts talk about the 2026 Notre Dame football team, it's identical to how they talked about 2025 Clemson and 2025 Penn State in the preseason. With that being said, in what ways is 2026 Notre Dame different and similar to those teams?
Go ahead, Drew.
I mean, I get the paranoia for sure. And I think the biggest concern is, I mean, you had with both of those teams, quarterbacks everyone talked about as a potential number one pick or top 10 pick, and they both either got hurt or seemed to regress. And for as much confidence as we do have in CJ Carr, he's going to be seeing a lot different defenses than he had last year. He doesn't have those security blankets in the backfield that, you know, that are... You know, he's probably going to get played a lot more often like he did against USC, where he kind of struggled a little bit. I think that was also because of the midseason stuff. So I think if you're looking for to add your paranoia, I guess that would be the biggest thing. But I think Notre Dame's defense just should be so good. They have all their coordinators returning. And I think that's going to be a security blanket while they have, and then they have some time to figure things out. I don't see them. They shouldn't have any games where they kind of falter early like those teams did last year.
Yeah, my biggest difference on the field would be CJ Carr is more reliable than Cade Klubnik. I want to read you guys some stuff. First of all, Penn State was just naturally put there when you finish in the Final Four, lose an all-time classic, and bring back your entire starting backfield and a good defense. So that was, you can say anything about Penn State being overvalued at the beginning of the year. That's just the natural, they would have been point, they would have been ranked there every year for the last 35 years in the top Final Four team. Whole backfield returns, good defense returns. You're going to rank them in the top five. Clemson, coming off 10-4, I just looked this up. They had the Pro Football Focus ranked them the number one ranked offense coming into the season, the number three ranked defense with the number one ranked offensive line and the number two ranked secondary. That is some hype for Clemson. I mean, they had four top 25 pro prospects per PFF going into the year. Two on the defense in the top five. That is serious hype. And Drew, you make a great point. you'd be worried if Notre Dame had this much hype opening at Miami and bringing in Texas A&M to start the season. That's just, they could grow into this season. They didn't have the luxury to grow into last year.
Well, look, I know that there were high hopes for Cole Klubnik last season, as well as Eller coming off the previous season. Neither of those guys I've ever thought were better than C.J. Carr.
Eller's not in the conversation of conversations.
No. And Klubnik proved that he's an above average quarterback, and that's it. I think I can't speak exactly for Clemson and Penn State's depth last year, but I'm sure it wasn't as good as what Notre Dame appears to have this year. And Marcus Freeman's a better coach than either of those two teams. So, I mean, I think what are the reasons Notre Dame can avoid it? I think there are many, and I think it starts with Marcus Freeman and the depth on this team and the abilities of C.J. Carr.
I got to give Dabo some credit, though, here. I wouldn't compare James Franklin and Dabo Sweeney to each other either.
No, I wouldn't.
Dabo Sweeney is a two-time champion.
I wouldn't either, but yeah, no, there's no denying that, but they don't play football like that now at Clemson.
They don't.
Yeah, Dabo Sweeney isn't 2018.
Yeah, they haven't played like the championship Clemson teams of several years ago now.
Our next question is from 2010 ND. Has there been any observations or intel on special team units? Specifically, have you heard or seen if we can kick a football with accuracy? And this is a two-parter with Baby Kyra. Any kicker sightings at practice this spring?
I hope you have some intel, Tio.
I do. I talked to Marty Biagi, but the number one thing is we know they can have a kicker that can kick the football because he did it for another school. He elected to become a student at the University of Notre Dame in the offseason, guys, Spencer Porath from Purdue. He then realized they had a football team, so he joined it, which is good for him. He's a really good kicker. And talking to Biagi about the last two kickers, he mentioned there was injuries, obviously, but there are unrelated injuries. They knew Burnett had an injury. They thought he could manage it. Mitch Keeter got hurt on a kickoff, and it lingered, and it hurt him until he was great in the playoffs. So Spencer Porath is going to be a lot better than either one of the kickers in the regular season. Let's just hope Spencer Porath can go 7-for-8 in the playoff like Mitch Keeter did. I think it was just really bad injury luck. Or you could judge Notre Dame for bringing in a guy that they were worried about with an injury, and Noah Burnett too, because the North Carolina writers from 24/7 were very surprised. Yeah. Notre Dame brought him in.
And he had slipped the year before at North Carolina.
That's right.
To answer the question, we have not seen any kicking in the
We haven't practices. Seen any kicking, though, no. But we've seen Porath kick in college football.
Yes, that we have seen.
Yeah, I agree. He went 15-17 last year in both of his misses. One was from 40-plus and one was from 50-plus. So he's definitely proved it on the field.
We have a question from Chris Koziak. We fast forward to January 27th, 2027. The Irish have won the national championship. What is the position group or groups that is the X factor and how they did it?
Go ahead, Drew.
I think I said this on a recent podcast or something similar, but I think it's the wide receiver group. I mean, I think it's the group with probably the most unrealized ceiling on this team, too. I mean, you look at all the talent, what I expect Jordan Faison to be able to do now that he's given up the cross and also based on his past success. So they have a lot of talented guys, and they have a quarterback who's going to want to push the ball down the field and probably pass more than they have in past years without Jeremiah Love and Jadarian Price in the backfield. So, I mean, I could also say, you know, the offensive line finally living up to expectations, but I think if they can have a wide receiver group who kind of excels and kind of meets its ceiling and its potential, I think that would be the X factor in them winning a championship.
For X factors for me is definitely receiver, because I think we talked a week or two ago that nowadays having the playmaking wide receiver is a differentiator when you get into playoff games. It's not just being able to hammer the ball at your opponent. Wide receiver and then defensive end, because if they have a pass rush, it is over. Notre Dame has a pass rush. They're going to blow the living doors off the first 13 teams they play. Not the first 12, the first 13. Then it gets a little different. But you're going to let Notre Dame host a playoff game or have a bye with a pass rush?
I think we're all assuming an awful lot with the defense, and it's, I think it's warranted. And the two keys, we know Boubacar Traore, but the two keys are Bryce Young and Keon Keeley. If those are big-time players, and I expect Bryce Young to take a significant step, and Keon Keeley just needs to be what, you know, some facsimile of what we thought Keon Keeley would be. And then you have that pass rush. I think they're solid. They're going to be solid at defensive tackle. But to answer the question, I hear what you guys are saying about wide receiver, and I agree. And I think it has a chance to be a much more dynamic group than what we've become accustomed to. But the offensive line needs to hit the ground running and have answers. You know, if Will Black is the starter, okay, that's a new insertion. We have another question about a backup offensive lineman beating out another offensive line. Joe Rudolph has a tendency to sometimes make some surprise choices up front. I'd like to see a pat hand in preseason camp. This is our group, and that group excels. And I think if they find some chemistry early in the season, all of my question marks really are on the offensive side of the ball, the receiver group improving. Can you have a more effective tight end room? The running backs without Love and Price, you know. So all my questions are there, and I think most of those questions are answered by having a cohesive unit up front with the offensive line. That's where I'm pretty old school, as you've noticed, so that's where I usually start.
Related question from Canadian Invasion. Scale of 1 to 10, how much of a chance do you give Matty Augustine to unseat Sullivan Abshire for the starting right guard spot? That goes to Priester's Pat Hand commentary. And let's start with that one first. What do you guys think about Augustine versus Abshire? Start with Tim, because I know you mentioned something to me in the first practice there that we saw the full one.
Well, I like Matty Augustine, and Notre Dame likes him too. But I would put a 3 on it, maybe a 2 or 3. I mean, we also have a tendency, the old guy, we want to see the new guy. Augustine was ranked the 450th composite player in the country when he came out, and Abshire was 24/7's 241. What is that? I mean, for whatever that's worth. But Abshire played good football after he got his feet wet a little bit. I don't want Augustine to beat him out. I mean, I shouldn't put it that way. If Augustine's better, that's what's best. But that's not the way it usually happens. Abshire's put in his time. It's his time. He's massive. And I thought he played pretty good football at the end of the season. So I'd put a 2 or 3 on it. I think Abshire's the guy for the spot. He's been in the program. That's who, all things being equal, that's usually who you want to win a job.
Yeah, I wrote down 2 or 3 as well, actually. And to your point about the recruiting rankings, I think Abshire's recruiting rankings took a hit because he went to an All-American game and they said he was like 3 inches shorter than he actually is. I don't know. Yeah, I remember that being really a real thing. Yeah, but he actually is 6'7", 320. So he is a guy with a lot of size. And I don't see it. I think the biggest thing is health. Like if he's healthy and he's not dealing with like some of the back issues or whatever he's dealing with last year, then Abser should be definitely the clear favorite. But yeah, I guess if that starts catching up to him, then it's going to give a guy like Augustine more opportunities to potentially catch him.
I think Abshire will win the job, but as Priester pointed out in the first practice, there's a reason Matty Augustine is behind Abshire and not behind Knapp on the line, because the competition would be with Abshire.
We think.
Well, he's not beaten out Knapp. Knapp will start.
No.
So that's one of those, sure, he'll start somewhere. Second part of this question is a fun one, nice and speculative. Those are always great. Irish Flyer 96, ranked the top 6 offensive linemen in terms of their ceiling. Sorry, Irish Flyer, I edited your question for content and enjoyment. Jagusa, Black, Craig, Lambert, Abshire, and Knapp. And is there a younger player you think would sneak into the group after that? Rank them by their ceilings. Let's go realistic ceilings, knowing everything we know about life, summer, off seasons, and surgeries.
Go ahead, Drew.
I'm going to change mine if we're including the surgery a little bit, because I had Jagusa as number one, just in terms of if somehow everything comes back, because I think he is, just in terms of size and what he can do and his flexibility, the most talented. But I'll adjust that if we're taking into account. And I'll have Black. I think he just moves differently. Followed by Lambert, who also, I mean, those two on their potential at left and right tackle is pretty incredible. And then I'll still put Jagusa there. I think those three in terms of ceiling are clearly the top. Knapp, I mean, in terms of his strength, what we've seen him do at left tackle, despite being a little undersized. Then I went Craig and Abshire.
I'm always changing the rules here. I'd put, you know, especially since Jagusa's injured, I'd put Lambert and Jagusa together at the top, and then I'd put Black, and then I'd pair up Knapp and Craig. I think when Craig's healthy, he's a really, really good center. Knapp is trending up, and I'd put Abshire last, maybe to the point of the previous question, but that doesn't mean that Abshire's not a good football player. If you rank them 1 through 6, somebody's got to be 6.
It's a list of 6 people.
Yeah, and so it's Absher, but not because I don't think he's trending up, because I really think that he is.
Illinois is the 4th best team in the Final Four. They're plenty good. This is nothing. They could win the Final Four. They're the 4th best team. It's fine. These things work out. I do want to remind everybody that when they do the freaks list every year, Anthony Knapp is the Notre Dame offensive lineman that's on it. When the strength and conditioning coach submits his freaks, it's Anthony Knapp.
Yeah.
However, I also agree that he would be about 4th on the ceiling. He has the lowest floor, Anthony Knapp, of this group by the widest of all margins going into the year. I am going to stick with Jagusa. Nobody. I'm going to change rule too. Nobody said it had to be before December this year. I'm going to stick with Jagusa as 1, Black 2A, Lambert 2B. I guess it'd be, 2A and 2B. Knapp 4. Absher's ceiling is lower than these other guys' ceilings for me. I just, the quality, he could be a better player than one of them this year too. He might end up being, if you rank the line at the end of the year, how they perform, he could easily be the 4th best, right?
Yeah.
Craig has 2 ACLs to deal with. I think there's a line of demarcation for highest ceiling, and it was the Jagusa Black Lambert thing, and then there's the very good lineman thing. I just want to point out that Anthony Knapp is a much better athlete than any Notre Dame fan gives him credit for, which is why he survived at left tackle, which might not be his best position.
Yeah, I see those three as like they could be first round talents, whereas Knapp is like a day 2 high end talent. Like that would be his ceiling for me, is kind of how I look at it.
Final question. Oh, Jack Freeman, I'm sorry. I did it again. I promise I would never end on a down note or another podcast in the offseason. Arrow fans 624. Here we go. Is it concerning that there has been a lack of public statements from Pete Bavakwa and Pat Garrity about the men's basketball season? While other universities are at least putting out statements that the season was a disappointment, they are committed to doing better. It has been crickets from Notre Dame.
It's like my Thursday thoughts.
Let me write in another question.
Thursday thoughts, I end with men's basketball, and then everybody comments on just men's basketball, not all the football stuff that I wrote above it. Well, crickets. In other words, you wanted Shrewsbury to be fired. The reason it's crickets is because they retained their coach. And I don't know what good public statements do. That doesn't
make you right.
That doesn't change anything. And I have no doubt that Pete Bavakwa and Pat Garrity are circling the hell out of the wagons. Because the wagons...
I've never heard that phrase used that way before.
The wagons the wagons are on the move. Brady Kaler staying was the best news that they've gotten, and we're still waiting to hear on the big 3. So, I don't know. They decided to keep their head coach. I know a lot of people disagree with that. I don't know what kind of proclamations you're making when you decide to keep a head coach that had one of the most horrible decision-making seasons that we've ever witnessed.
Yeah, I mean, my simple answer is the concern has nothing to do with the public statement. It's just there's a lot to be concerned about with the men's basketball team right now, so that's why it feels concerning.
Yeah, I don't think any statement would be well-received other than Marcus Burton and Jalen Harrelson have decided to come back. Like, until you can say something like that, I don't think you get a well-received statement. We are committed to building the best team through the transfer portal and recruiting and our head coach. What did Notre Dame fans say if that is the comment?
Pete Bavakwa spoke a ton when Notre Dame was left out of the playoffs. How'd that work out?
Yeah. And also, I don't think, I mean, Pat Garrity wouldn't comment publicly. He's the general manager. Does things behind the scenes. You could have an interview and a public interview with Pat Garrity like they did with Mike Martin once a year, but you already didn't hear Mike Martin talking about things. That his job is behind the scenes, and they have a tough job behind the scenes right now because they have 2 really talented individual players, one a homegrown and one kind of homegrown, not homegrown, but one close enough, and that's a lot of trouble. If they lose them, there's no statement that can be made that assuages anyone's feelings of anguish. We're going to throw in question number 10. CJ Carr is a top-tier Heisman Trophy candidate. Guys, comment on CJ Carr. We're going to end on a high note right here. What do you think about CJ? Good.
He's good awesome. Player? He's awesome. He has a chance to be even more awesome.
Yeah. Best deep ball at Notre Dame in decades.
I just like to say CJ Carr has to get stronger, but no, I'm just kidding. This has been a very enjoyable version of Irish Illustrated Insider Podcast. Drew, you've corrected me twice on this. We do have access along with 4 periods of practice this week, right?
I thought we didn't have four periods this week. I mean,
I don't.
I need to read these things a little closer. We're going to talk to people. We're going to talk to people this week, I promise, at Notre Dame.
Don't we have Freeman on Wednesday?
Yeah, that means.
Or has that changed?
That's even better.
So it's just him, right? These are things that all don't belong on a podcast. These are conversations to be held when we're not recording.
On a podcast, a review of a four-period practice where they don't go offense versus defense. Yet we put them on our podcast all the time. So we will have Marcus Freeman this week. Thank you, Tim Priester, for having the schedule.
Correct.
For Tim Priester and Drew Mentok of Irish Illustrated, I'm Tim O'Malley. Thank you for watching and listening. Irish Illustrated Insider. We like CJ Carr. He will be a Heisman candidate.
Book it.